I presume the movie is being transmitted over the air at a slow rate. In other words, 4 hours worth of transmitting gives you an hour and a half worth of movie. Does it work something like that?
Well, they had a bandwidth of about 3 megabits. And you got to consider that the average rate of a movie that plays DVD quality is around 3 megabits. You know, constant bit rate, peaking up higher. So it's almost real time, actually. So, you know, if the movie's 2 hours, it takes maybe 2 hours and 10 minutes to load.
Okay, you may be told this once before, and I've forgotten. This particular service that you're describing, what is it called, and how long has it existed, Eric?
Well, it originally started as Dotcast as part of something that PBS was doing. Then it was picked up by Disney, and it became MovieBeam. And then they spent like $100 million on it, and they sold it to, not Hollywood Video. Yeah, Hollywood Video. And they paid $10 million for it, and they just killed it a couple of weeks ago.
So they bought something and then killed it. It doesn't sound like a good investment. Are you saying not enough people knew about it, or there wasn't enough subscriber base to support it?
Well, Disney gave it up, so you have to start there. It was taking a while. But, yeah. I mean, they had users, but I don't know what they're using for.
Fascinating. Okay, before it gets too late, I think we should go over to Mel's mailbag. And Mel, I bet you've gotten some good juicy ones this week. And so, fire away with your first question. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, all right. Okay, Dick, I just looking over some of them now, and yeah, there's plenty of them. Oh, tons and tons of them. Here's a, you know, down the list here. Questions on phase lock loops, this gentleman's asking about. He says that they have so many terminologies on the phase lock loops, which I bob asking if we can more or less tell him what a lot of this so-called, I could say, jazz that refers to phase lock loop, what it means. So it's got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 questions. I don't know if should we tackle it or not. Over.
In reality, it's complicated, but it's a darn good question, Mel, because, and by the way, sorry I used the wrong call letters on you. K2KEY, K2LIW. The modern-day receivers, televisions, ham radio, whatever, everything's using phase lock loops, with rare exception. Nobody's got a permeability-tuned oscillator like the very expensive Collins 51J receiver used to have. Nobody uses that anymore. You know, purely analog frequency selection, free-running oscillators. Everything is a phase lock loop from the master oscillators. So learning how they work, learning the terminology. I'm doing research on a phase lock loop system right now. I've got a very critical requirement where I've got to produce two oscillators that have an exact relationship between each other, and those two signals have to be kept separated by more than 150 decibels for my particular application. So two completely separate phase lock loops with two completely separate power supplies are going to be required to fill my particular UHF requirement. I'm going to go step by step with this one. Make believe you had an oscillator that was on approximately the right frequency. Your FM feedback, or what is it called now, FM lock, or I forget what it's called in the case of an FM receiver, where it automatically steers itself to the right frequency. When you tune your FM receiver, when you're listening to a FM broadcast signal between 88 and 108 megacycles, let's assume you're listening to a PAT, 93.1 I think it is, and your receiver is tuned a little bit high. The output of your discriminator, the last stage of the IF strip that gives you the audio, that goes to the audio amplifier and then the loudspeaker, that discriminator when you're tuned a little bit high or a little bit low, produces either a positive or a negative DC voltage along with the audio. So the FM discriminator is telling you if you're mistuned. And if you take that voltage and feed it back to your oscillator, and the oscillator has a variable capacitance diode in the oscillator, so that when you change the voltage on that diode, you're changing its capacitance, and therefore it's making your oscillator move up or down in frequency, you close that loop between the output of the discriminator and your varactor diode variable capacitor network as part of your oscillator. It's called a voltage-tuned oscillator, for a VC, a voltage-controlled oscillator. You can see you can have FM feedback, and therefore your radio will, with an extremely small amount of error, realign itself so that even though you've got the dial set the wrong way, the radio will be on the right frequency when you're listening to that signal.
AFC.
That's the word I'm looking for, AFC, automatic frequency control. So our high-quality FM radios have had that for decades. Now, for one step further in accuracy, whenever you have a AFC circuit, you may have had 100 kilohertz of error before you close the loop of the AFC circuit. You close the loop and the 100 kilohertz of error goes down to 1 kilohertz of error, but there's always a little bit of error. If you want that error to get one step further into accuracy, you don't build a frequency feedback circuit, you build a phase feedback circuit. Phase lock loop instead of frequency lock loop, or AFC circuit. So when you have a master oscillator giving you a reference signal, and say for instance your reference signal is 10 megacycles, and assume that you want the oscillator to be on 90 megacycles, and if the oscillator is going into a counter circuit, so you want the oscillator to be on 90 megacycles, and you put it into a countdown circuit, which counts down between the 90 megacycles approximately the oscillator is running, and divides by 9, and out comes 10 megacycles. And you compare the 10 megacycle output of that divide by 9 circuit to your 10 megacycle reference oscillator. You compare the two and decide, is one higher in frequency than the other, or is one advanced in phase compared to the other? So it could be a frequency discriminator to get you in the right ballpark, and then a phase discriminator to get you into the right phase. And so you close that loop into that voltage-controlled oscillator, and you can end up with your 90-megacycle oscillator being exactly on the right frequency compared to your 10-megacycle reference oscillator. Not even one hertz of error. It'll have a little bit of phase error, but that's not a frequency error. Phase-lock loops can do that for you. And so now if you can change that divide circuit, at first you were dividing by 9, and that got you onto 90 megacycles. If you divided by 10, that would eventually end up with your oscillator on 100 megacycles. 100 megacycles divided by 10 comes back to a 10 megacycle output from your divide circuit. Again, you're going back to the same reference oscillator, 10 megacycles, and your electronics is making a decision, go up or go down. You're closing the loop in frequency at first to get into the ballpark, in phase later on to get into the right phase. And so now, as you can see, by programming the divider circuit that's sampling the output of my oscillator, I can force electronically the oscillator to be on exactly the right frequency. Assuming my 10 megacycle reference, assuming my 10 megacycle oscillator was high in accuracy and locked to National Bureau Standards, WWV, I could, in theory, have essentially zero error on my oscillator that in my two examples I gave you a 90 megacycle or 100 megacycle tuning just by changing the way I use the divider circuit. So by changing the programming of the divider circuit, I am forcing the oscillator to be on the right frequency. That's the first step of making a good phase lock loop system. That feedback network, we sort of glossed over it. In order for it to have the right phase shift, it's got to have usually a lead lag network. It's got to have the right Bode plot. It's got to have an operational amplifier. It gets a little bit complicated. But you go out and go to the right brand name, Motorola, National Semiconductor, Analog Devices, Silicon Laboratories, Peregrine. There's a whole lot of very good brand names of phase lock loop integrated circuit chips, where a high number of all of these stages are all built into one chip. In some cases, 90% of the whole Don receiver is built into a chip with these phase lock loops for the first oscillator. And if it's a dual conversion system, there's a phase lock loop for the second oscillator, for the second conversion, and so on. You buy the right chip, and nowadays, many of these integrated circuit chips for under $10, you're getting a hell of a lot of electronics in a very tiny package that does an extremely good job of putting your oscillator for your receiver on exactly the frequency you want. That's a bit of a thumbnail sketch of phase lock looping. And all the terms that go into it, the Bode plot, the phase margin, the stability criteria, the lead lag network, closed loop response, open loop response, ringing time, stability factor. Oh boy, when you get into the math and science of phase lock loops, you can spend a good fraction of a lifetime on that subject. Mr. Elric Rode of Rode and Schwartz, I can't remember his call letters right now, a very smart guy, wrote a very fast book.
You are.
Say that again?
The German call was DL4UR, and now he's got an American call now, Dick.
Yeah, when you look up DL4UR, and they'll also list all of his American calls, or you just look up Schwoz, I think his last name is pronounced Schwoz. You spell his name correctly, and you do a name search, you'll find all of his other calls, you'll find the call of his wife, his children, and whatever. It's a ham radio family. But he's written a beautifully well-accepted fat McGraw-Hill book, I think it is, maybe it's Prentice Hall, on phase lock loops. And the difference between a good one, a bad one, and an excellent one, there's all kinds of things you can do. As I said, there are people who have spent a good fraction of a lifetime studying all the fine details of making state-of-the-art phase lock loop oscillators. Every oscillator has a little bit of residual amplitude and phase modulation that on a perfect spectrum analyzer gives it some noise side lobes. And as you make that phase lock loop better and better, the oscillator becomes quieter and quieter, and when that becomes the local oscillator for a receiver, the receiver itself can have higher and higher performance. So it is a vast subject, almost as vast as the subject of antennas. But to a person who's interested in electronics and is willing to make the investment, in my opinion, it can be a very worthwhile investment if you think you need high quality in that particular component. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is K2KEY. I'll just say a few words. That Olert Rode, I had many conversations with him. And in fact, he was the one that gave me all the insight on how to convert over rebuild the HRO 500 receiver and modernize it, bring it up to standard, say. It's Rode & Schwartz is the name of his company. And as Dick said, he's written a number of articles on especially modern-day ways of building receivers, especially. And in fact, I did use the suggested frequency synthesizer that he suggested. And the original one that was in there had a lot of components, was a box with a lot of discrete components. And today, I was able to, get a Signetic IC that took up one hundredth. Of the space, and did the job a lot better because it's all built into this PLL. Alright, so let me see. Any questions or things I can comment on? Hold on. Let me read this over 1 second. Okay. A couple of factors here he asked about. The FRF, that's the, I guess he's referring to, they refer to the FRF, the frequency run frequency, is actually called the center frequency in a phase lock loop. It is actually the frequency of the VCO, the bullet control oscillator, with no input signal. And let's see, has another one. Natural frequency, the characteristic, that's basically when he asked the natural frequency. He's asking questions here, what these things mean. The NF, that's the natural frequency or the characteristic frequency of the loop. And then let's see, the LR, that's known as the locking range. That's the range of frequencies over what the loop will actually remain in lock. Also, I believe it's called the tracking range. So these are the things. I'm more or less familiar. I've done quite a bit of work also with PLL. So VCO conversion gain, that's the, what they call the K sub-zero factor. That's the conversion, the factor between the voltage controlled oscillator and the control voltage in actually it's what, how it's the determined, actually determined in what we call radian sector section voltage, basically. It's a little bit out of complicated to understand that. That's a bit of a study in it. But this is basically some of the terms that were asked about, Dick, over.
A phase lock loop is a kind of servo mechanism. That really means that you've got something that commands something to do something, the voltage to go up or down, say for instance a voltage regulated power supply, it's a kind of a servo mechanism. And there's a sampling circuit that says, okay, the voltage Mel desires out of this power supply is 12.0 volts, and right now the power supply is putting out 12.1 volts, and the sampling circuit says, hey, it's high, and it cranks back a signal to the control circuitry, turning it down. I mean, that's a servo mechanism. Well, an operational amplifier has got around 100 dB of gain inside of its little amplifier, and you've got a feedback network that's taking a sample of the output, feeding it back to the input out of phase, negative feedback, and you give it a disturbing signal on the input because you want the output to go higher or lower. And the way you do that feedback, you capacitively couple, resistively couple, inductively couple? Is it a circuit that leads in phase versus frequency or lags in phase? You can study the frequency response of the feedback network, and you could do a plot of gain of the network versus excitation frequency, frequency you apply to it, and you come up with a curve, which is called a Bode plot, because Mr. Bode, B-O-D-E, first did that work way back in the dark ages, and you can look at that curve and study it and make a conclusion as to whether or not your network is going to overshoot, undershoot, ring, be overdamped, underdamped, critically damped, and so on. What is the stability factor of your servo mechanism? So an operational amplifier usually is voltage output versus voltage input comparison, and it tries to follow your command. Well, instead of feeding back voltage, you can feed back the voltage that comes out of a phase discriminator or a frequency discriminator. Instead of producing a simple voltage for a power supply, you can be producing the voltage that goes into the control port of a voltage-controlled oscillator. So you're using slightly different components, but the overall block diagram still follows all of the mathematics of servo mechanism and stability and phase margin and so on. So the actual voltage-controlled oscillator, just like your amplifier, has a input-output characteristic, a throughput function, a gain function. In the case of an operational amplifier with 100 dB of gain, you put a microvolt in, and out comes a signal that is 100 decibels stronger. That's a transfer characteristic. And it does it with a certain gain versus frequency, and you can plot that. In the case of a voltage-controlled oscillator,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
In the case of a voltage-controlled oscillator, for each volt you put in to the control port, you get a certain frequency coming out of the oscillator. And the rate at which the frequency changes versus the rate at which you change the voltage in
It's sometimes called the K factor, the K0 factor. It's rated in megahertz per volt or hertz per volt, but change in frequency versus change in voltage. That is a gain stage that you can mathematically study, plug it into your diagram of your servo mechanism, which is the phase lock loop network, and come to the conclusion on paper, if you're smart enough, even before you build it, is it going to be stable? Will it have the right capture range? In other words, if the oscillator, when you first turn it on, sits at 88 megacycles, and you want to close the loop at 90 megacycles, does it have 2 megacycles of capture range? And after you do lock it, if the natural frequency of the voltage-controlled oscillator moves up to 93 megs, and you want it to stay at 90, does it have 3 megacycles of hold-in, lock-in range, so to speak? So capture range, holding range of the system, how far can the natural frequency of the oscillator drift and the whole network have enough loop gain to bring it back on frequency and do what you desire. These are some of the things that you study when you choose what brand name, what schematic diagram, whose configuration, what power output, and so on, what quality factor, which is called a phase noise factor, is your particular phase lock loop system going to have. As I said, people have studied these things for a good fraction of a lifetime because there's a lot to it. Mel and I are just trying to give you some of the buzzwords and a couple of the concepts, but I know you can't walk away whistling this tune yet. At least you know some of the buzzwords. K2KUI, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, very good, Dick. This is K2KUI, yes. As Dick was saying, the original concept, believe it or not, I mean, I did quite a bit of research on phase lock loops, being with the heart of the, basically, of the receiver that I was building. And it goes back, actually, to the 1930s, and was first known as the Homodyne system. That was, of course, done with tubes. And basically, what they were doing in those days, I mean, the description basically was that you took in a signal, an input to a signal input to a mixer, and then the output of the mixer, what they called that, at that time, they called that the error signal. It then went to a processing circuit. The outside of the processing circuit had a feedback network, and the feedback network actually went back to the mixer. So that was the basic of how the original phase lock loop came about, and was known at that time as the Homodyne, H-O-M-O-D-Y-N-E, Homodyne receiver of the 1930s, quite ahead of its time. And of course, to do it that was paid with a lot of vacuum tubes was quite a feat. And it wasn't until 1960 that a company called Synetic Corporation really started developing single chip PLLs. But, all right, a lot of terms here. You'll have to just read them over. Right? Low-pass filtering, natural frequency, phase detector, phase gain, lock range, VCO conversion, VCOs, and all this kind of jazz, dampening factor. That's all part of a PLL, and I could say it's, you really have to go through it. And there's a couple of pretty good books out there on it. Back to you, Dick.
Would you like to comment on the subject? Go ahead, Howie. Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
I was going to mention the charge pump. You have a charge pump at the output of your comparator that goes into your RMO. You have the low-pass filter. But the important thing, the Homodyne, Armstrong worked on it, and some of your FM, some of your original FM design used ratio detectors, so that was the beginning. And in the 1970s, around 71, 72, just for historics, the CB started using PLL chips. They had everything except the VCO. They had the built-in reference, you know, the built-in reference oscillator. They had the divide-by-end, the reference counter, and everything. So if you can also, you know, depending on, you know, you play with the programmable counter, and then you play with the divide by end that's on the reference frequency. And some of these people got very clever where they use one crystal in a CB rig at 10.240 megahertz, and the IF was 10.695, and if you subtract it, it came out to 455. So some people were very clever in how they set up their frequencies, so all they needed was one crystal in the whole radio. Over to you, Dick.
There's lots of ways of building a radio. Some of the early radios, Homodyne-like, that Mel was starting to describe to us, sometimes it's also called a zero IF radio, where the local oscillator going into the mixer is not 455 kc higher than the RF going in. That would produce a 455 kc IF output, which you amplify with IF scans and eventually detect in the FM or AM mode, or sideband mode. A Homodyne receiver, the local oscillator and the RF frequency on the exact same frequency and usually the exact same phase. When you do that correctly, the output of the mixer gives you the two side lobes, the upper and lower sideband, of the original modulation, and cancels almost everything else. Properly done, that can give you a very quiet, very high dynamic range receiver. It's got a couple of funny quirks. However, the modern day receiver that goes into an RFID reader, the radio frequency identification tags that are now starting to appear on our goods that we buy, in order to read the 96 bits of code that's programmed into that card, you have to pass the tag in front of a reader. When I say pass in front, some of the readers will read the tag at a 20-foot range. So the box that you care about that's got an RFID tag on it can be 20 feet away from you. You're walking up and down the aisles of this warehouse, and you program your handheld reader to find me tag number 45. And when you get within 20 feet of it, if you're aiming the interrogator in the right direction, the tag talks back to you, even though it's the second box on the back of the shelf and you can't even see it. And it's a perishable item, and you had lost that box and you hadn't seen it for the last month. And the tag will talk back to you and say, basically says, here I am. Here's my 96-bit code. Come and get me. I'm sitting here perishing. Basically what it's saying. Well, that is a Homodyne receiver, or you could call it a CW radar. The whole system is transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency, and it requires some pretty exotic antennas and some slightly fancy electronics to do it. You see it all laid out, it looks kind of simple, but there's a lot of technology hidden in there to make it all work right, so that, again, your transmitter doesn't jam your receiver. When you're transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency, to the nearest hertz, there's no way in hell that you can put a duplexing filter in there to separate the transmit signal from the receive frequency. There's no frequency offset. You can't filter 0 hertz away and separate outgoing versus ingoing. Yeah, you can separate it with directional couplers and circulators and other components. And so a Homodyne receiver, a modern-day
repeater, timeout, cancel.
A modern-day 2008 Homodyne receiver for RFID reception is another very interesting animal that, when it gets reapplied, even though it's an old-fashioned 1930 technique, when it gets reapplied in 2008 to both RFID readers, and I'm pretty sure ham radio operators are going to find another set of applications for this very crafty circuit. Once again, they combine that with computer interfacing. You ain't seen nothing yet. K2JEY, K2RIW in the technical net.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is K2JEY, yeah. Comes back to me. A lot of the terminology and different things that I did look into when working with it. As Dick was referring to also, those Homodyne type of receivers of the 1930s. The technical... I remember reading the technical bulletin that was printed in the IEEE was actually called Method of Synchronous Reception. I remember that pretty well reading. It was very interesting to read. 1936, Synchronous Reception. And that was later on, they coined the word Homodyne Homodyne receiver system. So anyway, that's basically, I could say, it's a whole study in itself. That today, fairly easy to go ahead and work these things into a piece of equipment because it's all usually contained in the IC today. So, but if you want to know the nitty-gritties of it, you can look up a number of different places, especially the discussions by Ulrich Rode, one of the co-owners of Rode Schwartz Corporation. All right, I think we'll go on, Vic, over.
Yeah, you did mention synchronous discriminator, synchronous demodulation. A year and a half ago, I worked on a project that used a synchronous demodulator properly implemented. That can suck a signal 30 or 40 dB out of the noise, and I was doing just that. It was an extremely weak signal with a very minor modulation on it that I had to detect in an extremely noisy environment. And lucky for me, I had a reference signal to tell me where the weak signal was in frequency. And as such, with a synchronous demodulator, which is another doodad you can add to a Homodyne receiver, it's another variation, so to speak, of a Homodyne receiver, boy, that can produce some real magic. Back to you, Mel, and have we read enough of the terms of phase lock loop? And by the way, if you Google the word phase lock loop, guarantee you get a million hits. Lot of information on that subject. And as I said before, you can invest a good fraction of a lifetime studying that subject. And after you spend half a lifetime studying it, if you're objective and realistic, you'll say, okay, I know 90% of what there is to know about this, but I'll never know it all. KQKEY, KQRIW.
I think, if I be honest with you, Dick, when I was talking to Ulrich, I think I most likely spent more time on discussing the synthesizer, the phase lock loop next to the filter circuits. I drove the poor man crazy, but he was very nice about it. He worked with a friend of mine at RCA, who was working at that time some years ago at RCA Worldwide Communications in New Jersey. So he got a K2 call. I'm trying to remember his K2 call now. I got it written down. And he would join us on 75 meters and wind up as we talked to the wee hours of the night. He loved to discuss this subject. So, and he wrote, I could say, extensively in a number of magazines on this stuff. So, you know, just like you say, if you Google it, you'll most likely find plenty of information on it. But to delve into each one of the different terminologies, there's many terminologies involved with PLLs. You got to really dissect them one at a time. Okay, shall we go on to the next one, Dick?
Roger, Dodger.
Okay, I'm reading down here. Basically, I can say we do this spontaneous, so give me a second and see if I can come up. Okay, here's. Ah, this is a good one for you, Dick. There's a 13-element 432 open quad antenna that's marketed in Italy called the RAI Corporation. Marketed by I2RR. He has a 13 open quad 432 antenna, which he claims 13 elements, and it gains 17 dBd. Front to back ratio 28 dB, front to side 46 dB, and a feed point peak around 100 ohms. Do you know anything about this antenna? Open quad antenna. I think I've seen them, Dick, not for 432, but I believe for 144. Go ahead.
Okay, the first thing I complain about a little bit is that the gain claim is high. If he said 17 dB over isotropic, I would almost accept it. 17 dB over dipole with only 13 elements, even though the cubical quad elements. And by the way, as the Yagi gets longer and longer, and you've decided to make the elements out of cubical quads, loops, triangles, or dipoles, doesn't matter. A long Yagi doesn't matter. I mean, the apparent improvement in performance you might have on a two- or a three-element cubical quad disappears when the Yagi becomes long. To me, 13 elements is a long Yagi by the Ed Tilton definition of way back in the 1970 time frame. So a long Yagi with 13 elements
around 15 dB over dipole is about the best you're going to do. When it comes to measurements that are made traceable to the Bureau, the expert worldwide on that arguably is Dr. Gunter Hahn, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform, DL6WU, Dr. Gunter Hahn in Darmstadt, Germany, who works for the many years for the German Federal Post Office. The anechoic chamber is what he was in charge of. He would take everybody's Yagi design, build a 432 version of it, and go into the laboratory and test them. He's got a zillion articles in the German magazine, which has an English translation, by the way, on what gain you can get for what boom length and what number of elements. And I'm pretty sure you'll find that no matter whose design you're talking about. And he's gathered probably 50 or more different Yagi designs around the world, maybe even 150. But he's put a lifetime into studying Yagis. And his curves in his articles will tell you exactly what you can get. I mean, there are certain things you just can't do. I can say that I'm going to start flapping my hands, and I'm going to build up my arms and my muscles real strong, and by flapping my hands, I'm eventually going to fly. Well, you do a little bit of back-of-the-envelope calculation of how heavy I am, how much wing area I've got in my hands, and how strong are my muscles. You'll rapidly come to the conclusion that I cannot get there from here. The laws of physics just won't let me do that. By the same token, with 13 elements, I don't think you can get 17 decibels of gain. So that gain number is high. Now, it may be a darn good antenna. It may have good mechanical integrity. It may have a good standing wave ratio curve. It may have all kinds of nice properties. But its gain claim, in my opinion, is a little bit high. And now you know some of the reasons why ARRL no longer accepts the gain claim on any of the advertisements for antennas. So I don't know that brand name. But the easiest way to find out is it a good brand name is to try to find
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You may have to find an Italian amateur or a guy in France, somebody in Europe. But if you really want to buy that brand of antenna, if you think it's the best bang for the dollar for you, to get a testimonial is a very good way to go. I wish there was a central organization worldwide. The closest we had during his activity, Gunter Hock is now essentially retired to my knowledge. But for a period of time, you could say he was the central clearinghouse for all the world's Yagi designs. And even if a man had a 13-element, a 15-element, and a 19-element version, he would build and rate every one of them. So you go to his appropriate article. He was the Consumers Union of Yagi Antennas. That's my word for it. And you could, in the past, go to his set of curves, and he would tell you exactly what that antenna is capable of doing. Now, if you buy an antenna where the gain claim is 17 and the real gain you get is 15, that is not bad. For that amount of boom length, 13 elements of 432, probably is around 11 or 12 feet of boom length. For 11 or 12 feet of boom length, if you get 15 dB over dipole, 17 dB over ISO gain, that's an extremely good antenna. The first side lobe, if it's a state-of-the-art antenna, the first side lobe should be around 17.5 dB down. The second side lobe should be around 22 dB down. You can make the side lobes weaker if you want to. The gain will go down when you do it. You can make the side lobes stronger than those numbers if you want to. The gain, again, will go down if you do it. If you adjust for the side lobes exactly 17.5 for the first and 22 dB for the second, you'll get the maximum gain out of that antenna. Of course, that sounds crazy. You have to dig a little bit deeper into the physics of what's called diffraction-limited directivity, and you'll soon discover that those numbers are set in bedrock. And not set by the ham radio operators, set by the guys that were building parabolic mirror optical telescopes. A diffraction-limited optical telescope is the highest gain you're ever going to get out of that particular number of square feet or square inches of mirror area. And by the same token, they've discovered that a diffraction-limited telescope, what do they call it now? The airy disk. The airy disk, which really means the side lobes, in the pattern that you get on a telescope, is identical to the side lobes you get on a long Yagi. And so you adjust for those side lobes amplitudes, you'll get the best possible gain. Front-to-back ratio is a nice thing to brag about. If it's anything more than 10 dB, it's a brag. Because every antenna at some very sharp angle in the back can easily have a very deep notch. You find that deep notch, it's 31 dB down, and you...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You find that notch 31 dB down, and you start bragging that you got a 31 dB front-to-back ratio. Yeah, you do have it, but you only have it over half a degree in azimuth off the back end of the antenna. Is that significant? Not very. Front-to-side ratios are nice to brag about. Front-to-back ratios are nice to brag about. They don't mean much. Real forward gain, real 3 dB beamwidth. And by the way, if he really did have 17 dB of gain over dipole, his forward lobe beamwidth would be under 23 degrees. Guarantee he hasn't got that with only 13 elements. So there's ways you can apply checks and balances to this. But despite the fact he's a little bit exaggerated in the gain numbers and maybe in the side lobe levels and front to back levels, it could be a very fine antenna. So you think that these numbers are the real discriminants that allow you to select a good one from a bad one. To a degree, that's true, but now you've got to hone your criteria a little bit. What do you really need? Do you want maximum gain? Do you want the best gain-to-temperature ratio because you're doing moon bounce? Do you really need as broad a back lobe as possible, but as many dB down as possible, because you're aiming the antenna at Europe and you got a whole bunch of guys to the west of you that are giving you QR Mary? That's a rare situation. But like everything else, it's a little bit more complicated than the first meets the eye. K2KEY, K2LAW, finally listening.
QIQ with a question.
That's the QIQ. I think it's Gordon. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick question. On a Yagi antenna, if you had a device that could tune the right at the antenna, the directing elements, that you basically as you change frequency, you could always keep a perfect match to your 50 ohm cable right at the antenna. How much bandwidth could you get on the antenna swinging to either side? That's kind of like a maximum for gain and directivity pulls up so far that it's not a very effective antenna anymore.
You could say, Gordon, the stepper IR antenna, where there are stepper motors on every one of the elements, driven elements and all the parasitic elements of the antenna. They got a two-element, three-element, and a four-element, maybe even a five-element version of it. It does just that. If you leave the position fixed, but you properly tune the length of all the elements, driven and parasitic, you could easily make a Yagi cover tremendous frequency regions, particularly if you're willing to use it in the harmonic modes. The stepper IR antenna, I believe there's a version that works on everything from 20 through 6 meters, 20 meters through 6 meters inclusive, by using harmonics and whatever. If you don't have to have the absolute maximum gain, it is my belief that there is a magic length and position for all of the directors for the absolute maximum gain. However, there are a zillion variations of the Yagi design where a tiny bit of decrease in gain can allow you all kinds of variations and spacings and lengths. There's a combination of spacings and lengths where the director string gives you a particular synthesized dielectric material, synthesized slow wave structure. Not too different from a dial guide antenna, an antenna made out of a plastic rod. It has a certain velocity profile. In other words, the wave coming down that Yagi has a certain rate at which it's allowed to propagate, depending on the length and the positions of those directors. And when you make a graph of the velocity of the wave going down the boom for the various positions on the boom, and when you fit that curve into a particular velocity profile, the whole director string starts acting like a magnifying glass. It focuses all those sun rays down to that fine point, and you burn a hole in the driven element. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean here. That's how the Yagi phenomena works on long Yagis. It is a synthesized magnifying glass. It doesn't look like it, but through that wave it is. So if you now need tremendous bandwidth, well, let me backtrack. The military has for many years essentially ignored the Yagi antenna, because all of those antennas that they put on aircraft, because The real estate for the antenna is very restricted on an airplane. Therefore, they demand that every one of the antennas they put there, with rare exception, have at least an octave of frequency coverage, a 2-to-1 frequency range or more. That forces them into some pretty low-gain antennas, but it solves their problem. And yes, in the early days of World War II, Yagi antennas were hung on the front end of airplanes for radar purposes, narrowband. The good news about a Yagi is you get a lot of gain in a small package with very little metal and very few dollars. But the Yagi tends to be only... The Yagi tends to be only a few percent in bandwidth. By way of the Gunter Hack variation of the tapered designs of his directors, he has essentially doubled the bandwidth that everyone else is getting with very little sacrifice in gain. In some cases, he seems to come out ahead in gain. Common sense would lead you to believe by gain bandwidth product considerations, if you make the antenna more broadband, you think it's going to have less gain. Well, he's come up with some Yagi designs that seem to defy that a little bit. If you really want super bandwidth and super high gain, maybe you want a dish, because now the bandwidth is as broad as the feed horn you can build. And with log periodic techniques, you can build feed horns that cover a 10-to-1 frequency range. The Yagi design, to cover more than, I'm going to pick a number, 10% bandwidth for a long Yagi, is very difficult. If you do have enough wherewithal by stepper motors and whatever, so that you can tune the positions and lengths of all the elements, you can make the Yagi work almost DC to light. It's a matter now of your mechanical smarts and how much you're willing to invest. And if you try to cover that much frequency range, should you do it with these very elaborate stepper motors all over the place, or should you build a couple of different Yagis for different bands and stack them on top of each other? The second approach that I just mentioned is the more traditional approach, and I think it's going to give you more bang for the dollar. I will admit the stepper motor approach, carried to its logical extreme, would be a pretty exotic antenna that, as long as you've got the wherewithal and the time, it would be fun to build and a lot of fun to brag about. Gordon, KC2QIQ, I think it is, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Yeah, you're right on around the money, which is basically where I'm going. But one of the experiments I wanted to try, and I just wasn't sure whether I tried it, I do have an antenna tuning device that's remote, and I could actually put it right up on the beam. And I've seen 10 and 11 meter beams that are relatively inexpensive, and I figured if I were to put the tuning device and isolate the driven element and just drive it directly with the tuning box right at that driven element, I was wondering, could I actually cover between, let's say, like 10 to 20 meters? But I think what's relatively going to happen is I'm not going to have enough directivity and gain as I get towards 20 meters. But it was something that where I started experimenting with smaller antennas, and it was seeming like maybe there was about a 3 dB loss in gain, but I wasn't sure if the principle really works, but it might.
Yagi antennas, properly built, are thoroughly scalable. If you've got a design for a 10-meter Yagi that gives you a gain and a pattern that you like, and you decide you want a 20-meter Yagi instead of a 10-meter Yagi, and you take every single dimension and simply double the dimension, you will, by definition, get the exact same gain, the exact same pattern, the exact same Vizwar curve, and so on. Yagi antennas, like many other antennas, are thoroughly scalable. So if you're smart enough to put in enough stepper motors to change the length and position, you can get the exact same performance on every frequency. I didn't say it's easy, but it is doable. If you saw a 3 dB of less gain when you went to the other frequency, then you didn't change enough of the dimensions to the right magnitude yet. But the antenna itself is thoroughly scalable. And when I say scalable, I mean really scalable. If you had a whole lot of real estate and you build a really beautiful three-element Yagi on 80 meters, and you took that exact same design and scaled it to 1296 from 80 meters, and you scaled every single dimension, you would get the exact same performance. I wonder if that was known to you before tonight, Gordon. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the technical net.
No, thanks, Dick. It's very informative. Some of it I'm familiar with. You know, I've been working with a lot of the modeling programs, and, you know, I was looking at it, and I was just wondering, you know, if you just change the impedance, you know, driving impedance of the driven element by itself, you know, how far you can really go. And it's kind of pretty much along the same lines of what I was seeing with the data was shown. Oh, by the way, the name is Glenn Mason, KC2QIQ.
Sorry about that, Glenn. By the way, I have done a lot of swept Yagi designs over the last 4 years. In other words, I'm looking at them on a network analyzer that's scanning an octave in frequency, and the antenna that I'm tuning only has 5 or 10% bandwidth. And what I've discovered on a three-element Yagi, and I know that this phenomenon gets more and more severe when you make a 4, 5, 6, 10, 15-element Yagi. As you sweep in frequency, the gain falls off because the directors are the wrong length for that new frequency. And the fall-off in gain is pattern degradation much faster than VISWR. You and I would like to have all of our antennas have a 1.2 standing wave ratio, 1.2 to 1. And we think with the antenna, you start sweeping it above design frequency and below design frequency, and the VISWR goes to 2 to 1, and we think that's terrible. A 2 to 1 VISWR is only half a dB of loss. You sweep that Yagi far enough that the VISWR of the driven element goes from 1.2 up to 2 to 1 because of the pattern change, or because you now have mistuned directors. You may have 4 decibels of gain fall off, but only half a dB of that is due to VISWR of the driven element. So VISWR of the driven element is a good thing to strive for. It's not the most critical thing that happens when you sweep the frequency of a high-performance Yagi. Pattern fall-off, because the director string is not properly tuned, that is much more sensitive than VISWR sensitivity. I wonder if that makes a little sense, Gordon. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I was looking at this, and I'm looking at the practicality of it, you know, taking like a 10-meter or 11-meter beam that was relatively inexpensive, putting the auto-tuner up there, but as I said, you know, you can get, 7, 8 dB of gain, and then you're down to like about 5, so, somewhere in that area. It's probably not all that practical and working for it, but that FIR, that's a beautiful antenna. That's just one of these days I got to get a tower and put one up. Back to you, Nick. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me do one more sentence of reinforcement on what I just said. I've got this Yagi well-tuned to my favorite frequency, and I sweep it to a higher frequency with the signal generator, and I'm now at a frequency where the gain is 4 decibels lower. Forward main lobe gain, foresight gain. If I then retune the driven element to make it perfect, I've got enough reactive and resistive readjustment capability of the driven element. I retune the driven element. The 4 dB of gain fall off becomes 3.5 dB. I can gain back the half dB of loss at the driven element due to standing wave ratio. And until you've actually worked with Yagi, you think there's some kind of a complicated relationship between VISWR of the driven element and the pattern of the Yagi. There is no relationship. They're independent phenomena. Let me drop for a second. In other words, for a Yagi to work well, all the directors have to have the right length and the right position in three-dimensional space. For the driven element to work well, all it has to do is give you a good impedance match to your transmission line and radiate in a dipole-like manner. That's all it's got to do. If you go to the bottom of the page on WA1MBA.org, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha.org, the Tom Williams page, on the bottom of that page, you'll find an article by K2RIW. You read it, and you'll see this all reinforced. So that there is no relation. The gain of the Yagi and the VISWR of the driven element are thoroughly independent phenomena. You can change one, and they interact, but one is independent from the other. You can be tuning a Yagi. You can be adjusting the elements of the directors, and the gain jumps up 1.5 dB, but the VISWR jumps to 2 to 1. And you can independently retune the driven element to get the VISWR back down to 1 to 1 without changing the director positions or lengths. They're independent phenomena. And once a person learns that,
In many cases, it gives him a hell of a lot more freedom to design his Super Yagi if that's what he wants to do. Thank you for any further questions on this, Glenn. KQRIW and the technical man.
Yeah, thanks for the answer, Dick. KQ2, QIQ.
Okay, Mel, you've got it. And go on to the next one if you want to.
Okay, just one question I was going to ask here. I was just thinking about this open quad, getting back to the original question, the open quad type of director design, being that you're talking about directors. If we have open elements, open quad elements, would that give make it a higher Q element and actually increase gain? So they go hand in hand. In other words, what I'm saying, a higher Q of the director element will increase the gain because they're open. Is that a factor, Dick? Does that make sense? Over.
Okay, I've got a strong feeling about this one, but let me make sure I'm not going off half-cocked. Define for me the word open quad element. Does that mean it's a full wavelength loop that doesn't close on itself, it's got a gap? What does the word open quad element mean, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, you know, years ago there was a open quad 144 megahertz antenna. Now, basically the director, in other words, you took dipole, you took, in other words, a full wave dipole on 144, and you bent it over into an angle, you know, it's a right angle, and you put two of them on the same support. So you had two open dipoles that would form a, basically if it was closed, it would be a quad element, a full wave quad element, but you're splitting it on both sides. So they call that open quad element, Dick, over.
Okay. If I took a cubical quad and I'm using it in the diamond configuration, and you've got a half wavelength of inverted Z on the top and a half wavelength dipole, non-inverted Z on the bottom, an ordinary Z on the bottom, and they usually attach together. The left-hand apex and the right-hand apex are the high voltage points. If I cut the wires in those points, so that now there's a gap there that wasn't there before, except for the minor change in fringing capacitance at that point, I have not changed the tuning of the upper half-wave dipole and the lower half-wave dipole. They have the identical Q, the identical spacing of phase centers, the identical bandwidth, everything is the same. The fact that they're open, it's almost academic in my opinion, except for a little bit of difference of fringing capacitance out there because you've removed some material in the process of opening and separating them a little bit. Very minor variation. Now, when it comes to the Q of parasitic elements of a Yagi, we got to be careful here. The word Q has got four separate meanings, but the realistic meaning of Q is how much resistive loss is there, how much I squared R loss. If I'm running the antenna with 100 watts going into it for 10 minutes, and if I'm looking at it with a thermal imaging camera that can measure temperature differences to the nearest tenth of a degree Fahrenheit, does anything on the antenna get hot? That's a mechanism of insertion loss, of dissipating power. If the antenna runs ice cold with 100 watts into it for 10 minutes, then by definition it is a 100% efficient antenna, or damn close to it. You put 100 watts into it, and the 99.9 watts is radiated somewhere into space. Now, once I strip myself to using quality materials, so I've got an antenna that passes that test. Now, the next thing you and I care about is, what is the real bandwidth of the Yagi if I go above and below the design frequency? At the design frequency, if I'm smart enough, I make those directors the right length, the right positions, I get the gain and the pattern, the front-to-back ratio, I get all of those parameters if I'm smart enough. I did computer modeling, I did good tweaking in the backyard, an antenna range, I've got a good antenna. But now I want to sweep it in frequency, I want to go above and below the design frequency, and I'd love all of that great performance to stay there. And so now we're about to start talking about the Q of the parasitic elements. If I build the parasitic elements, and this is something I've done recently, out of extremely wide pieces of sheet metal, instead of building them in the dipole-like manner, you do, with proper tuning, and it's a new tuning procedure, you do end up with more bandwidth.
maybe twice as much bandwidth as you had before. But I'm talking about a huge...